Welcome back to another episode of the Mindshift podcast. My name is Luca Becella and I will be your host for today. I'm truly privileged to bring to you this special episode. I've got two amazing guests with me on the podcast today, dear friends of mine who are also experts in this field in their own right. Today we'll be discussing cryptocurrency, the industry that's taking the world by storm and that is also trying to overthrow the legacy financial system. This is a topic that I've really become interested in over the past few years. And since COVID began, it's really taken me by storm. So I've really dug my heels into it a lot more. And the nature of the beast is that the more you go down the rabbit hole, the more ideas you discover, the more people you discover that you need to follow, and the more topics and things that you need to cover. So this is the exact reason why I've brought these two guys on the podcast today to discuss these ideas with me, give their opinions, and just to break down the foundations of cryptocurrency. As you'll inevitably hear, there's a ton of meat to this topic. We ended up actually recording for over 2 hours, so I decided to split the episode down the middle and bring it to you in two parts, just to minimize the cognitive load on your brain. And as with any topic of this nature, everything we say in this podcast is not investment advice. It's just our opinion. So please do your own research before trying anything silly. So in this first episode, in part one, we take a deep dive into Bitcoin, the OG cryptocurrency that was created by Satoshi Nakamoto, the pseudo-anonymous famous person in the person, male, female, or group of people in the cryptocurrency industry who launched the cryptocurrency in 2009 in the depths of the global financial crisis. Along with how Bitcoin works and what it means for the world, we touch on the foundations of what money is, because this is really the backbone of the idea that Bitcoin finds itself in the world, the macroeconomic environment, and the economic theory that underpins Bitcoin and that runs parallel with the thesis. We discuss what mining is, what proof of work is, how blockchains work. We also touch on the institutional investment and the trillions of dollars that are surely to come into this industry. We touch on the Bitcoin community and much more. So please, without further ado, please enjoy the Mindshift Beginner's Guide to Bitcoin. I've got Luca Steiner, don't be confused by him having the same name as me, and John T. Quinnett on the podcast with me. Yeah, we've got a special episode for you today. Just as a bit of context, I think this episode is geared towards those people as an introductory primer to what crypto is, what the world is of Bitcoin, Ethereum, and everything else that comes with it. If you haven't seen Bitcoin pop up in the news, you must have been, not really interested in finance at all or whatever, but I'm sure it's definitely popped up for you. And if you've sort of been sitting on the sidelines wondering what this thing is, being a bit skeptical, is this thing just fake internet magic money and a bit of a Ponzi scheme? I hope we can then sort of open up the curtain and shed some light on what this thing actually is and how I guess we believe this is going to have a profound impact on the world. And just to put things into context, at the time of recording, per CoinMarketCap, the overall market cap of crypto is sitting at around $3 trillion. Bitcoin is currently trading at around $60,000, Ethereum $4,000. And there's just been a huge run up in the past few weeks. And I guess with that comes all the media hype. So I guess this episode is coming at a sort of, not necessarily an inflection point, but sort of a hype moment, I guess, as we like to refer it in the crypto world. And just as an introductory to crypto, I guess, I was listening to something with Naval Ravikant. And if you don't know who he is, I strongly recommend you go listen to his interview with Joe Rogan. He describes crypto as a brain virus when you first understand it and realize what it can actually mean to the world, in that you can never stop thinking about it. And you just want to dive deeper, learn more about it. I was also listening to something, a breakdown of Ethereum, the second biggest cryptocurrency, which we will be deep diving into this episode, with Justin Drake, a researcher at the Ethereum Foundation. And he basically described crypto as the biggest rabbit hole that humankind has ever created. And once you get into the rabbit hole, it's extremely hard to jump out of it. And he spent 8-10 years of his life in the rabbit hole building for Ethereum and researching for the Ethereum Foundation. And I guess for me, I discovered crypto in 2017. I'm sure when a lot more people did, when there was that crazy just time, complete mania, hysteria about crypto. Didn't pay much attention to it. And then during COVID, I guess it came back onto my radar with everything that was happening in the global economy, which we will discuss. So just to then introduce my guests after me talking for way too long, I've got Lucas Steiner here and Jonty Quinnett. I've got an introduction for you. I've got an introductory question for you, gentlemen. Could you give, when I ask the question, just give a quick, brief 30 seconds on who you are and how you got stuck into crypto, I guess, and then I'll go ahead and ask my question. So, Luca, what's your background and how did you get into crypto?
I studied engineering at UCT, jumped across for a master's in financial risk management, financial markets, and I actually came into contact with crypto first through our good friend, Jonty. And that's how it started for me.
And you've been down the rabbit hole ever since. And Mr. Quinnett, our other amazing guest, whose physical identity will remain anonymous for now.
Maybe you guys will get a sneak peek later on. My trading career began when I was 13. I started trading stock markets when I was 13, 14 years old. And basically throughout high school and my also engineering degree that I studied, Luca and I actually studied together. I was always trading the stock markets in the background until I came across cryptocurrencies and what Bitcoin was, mid to late 2019. And what I started doing was I started to trade sort of arbitrage. So buying Bitcoin with dollars and selling it for rand. So there was always an arbitrage rate between the currencies. And then ultimately, I kind of thought to myself, this is pretty awesome. Let me actually do a little bit more deep diving into what Bitcoin is. And, when I did that first Google search, the rabbit hole opened and it was just one way from there.
I guess it's probably appropriate right now to formally announce that you are full time in crypto now. You are fully down the rabbit hole now every basically waking second. You've got a brilliant Discord community going and we'll probably mention that as a plug towards the later end, but anyway, to dive into things, posing a first question to you guys, what was sort of the, and before we start running through our basically agenda for the episode, what was the moment for both of you that you realized that this crypto thing is serious? It's not just sort of a fad or something that's going to, end in a couple of years, or it's a Ponzi scheme or something. When describe the moment, or if there is a moment that happened, whether it was with Bitcoin or Ethereum or whatever, what did that moment look like? And what was your thought process? Jonty, if you want to start.
So there was a very clear moment when I realized, crypto is the future. It was a couple months into my sort of retail buying into cryptocurrencies where I wouldn't really do much research. I just kind of, buy the next altcoin that I was thought would do crazy returns because some influencer on YouTube was talking about it. And, that moment came when we had this lovely pandemic and, we all got sent into lockdown and I kind of, arrived at my farm for the lockdown period. And I sat there and realized that, you know, all my day job work had pretty much just been put on hold for the remainder of that year. And I kind of said to myself, I was like, you know what, I can either, you know, play games and do nothing with my life for the next couple of months and wait for things to go back to normal, or I can kind of be proactive about this. So I started, you know, researching a bit more into what I was actually doing in the space and what I wanted to do in the space. And, you know, the moment I realized, like, why we were going into, you know, why we had recent global issues in the financial sectors and why we've had, you know, all these issues with inflation globally and issues in sort of traditional finance, I kind of realized that the only solution to it is crypto. And I started, you know, looking more and more into the whole sort of cultural significance of what cryptocurrency could bring. And it just got me more and more and more excited. And, you know, within that first week of lockdown, I was doing, you know, multiple online courses with various universities overseas, studying the fundamentals and the basis of blockchain technology and, you know, the efficiency that it can bring to traditional sectors. And yeah, I mean, from there on, it just exploded in my mind. And it's been like a brain virus, as you said earlier in the call. And it's just developed since then. So it was a very, yeah, I was a few months into the degen lifestyle before I realized the true capability of what cryptocurrency can bring to the world.
And I guess a lot of those themes that you touched on there, we'll definitely talk about, you know, especially the problems with the monetary system and loads of other issues that have basically come about because of the money we are transacting in and are most used to. And Luca, what about you? What was the sort of inflection point or realization moment for you?
Well, I started working in Frankfurt when the pandemic kicked off. So it took a bit longer for me. And I think the key inflection point was really when Bitcoin started landing on corporate balance sheets. Michael Saylor's session on Bitcoin for corporate strategy it blew my mind. I think that would be a fair inflection point for me. Yeah.
And I mean, for me, that was also a huge moment. I think that was actually my sort of inflection point moment where it was like, whoa, like something, because I was actually listening to Naval on a Tim Ferriss podcast, and they had this tiny segment about crypto, and it was like the most insignificant thing when you look back at it. It's like, how did you only realize it then? But they just mentioned something about, because I was ignorant to the news of Michael Saylor through for people who don't know, Michael Saylor is the CEO of MicroStrategy, and he famously purchased a boatload of Bitcoin basically last year, August, I think was his first trade. And he's now put it on his personal and his company's balance sheet. And his company being MicroStrategy is a public company which survived the dot-com bubble and everything. And I think for people who don't know, I think that's a really important person to follow in crypto, especially Bitcoin. And that for me was the moment where I was like, wait a second, there must be something more to this thing if public companies are actually wanting to put them on their balance sheets, and think about all the regulation and that they have to go to the red tape. And if they're willing to make that happen, then I should probably pay attention too. So then I began to pay more attention. But before we get ahead of ourselves, because I'm already getting very excited, as we all do, we have a lot of conversations offline about this stuff. Let's backtrack, right? So we know that Bitcoin, Ethereum, cryptocurrency is becoming ubiquitous as money in a sense, not ubiquitous in terms of the 7 billion, 8 billion people in the world, but there's a narrative that's being driven. And we can all see where the space is going, and the features and the groundwork have been laid. So I want to backtrack and ask you guys what you think. What is money? If you were to answer that question, what is money? It's quite an odd question. But I mean, to you guys, and this will be informed by your deep dives into crypto, what is money? Luca?
Sure. Well, I guess we can look at the key functions of money: medium of exchange, store of value, and unit of account. I guess The unit of account aspect is what got us past the barter economy. You can't have, you know, 100,000 relative prices in mind. You need some baseline. And I mean, the store of value is one of the more contentious issues and also quite relevant for this whole kind of cultural phenomenon, and obviously medium of exchange, something that's practical. So I think we went from shells to metals to paper, magic money, and now magic internet money. Quite literally, and just on that point, actually, there is a crypto project which has a stable coin, which is called Magic Internet Money, money with the ticker MIM.
And the
so quite literally, you can plot that progression.
And that protocol is called Abracadabra Money. It's full magic, guys. It's full magic.
But I think we get it. Let's bring it back. Let's bring it back, guys. And Jonty, if you were to answer that question, what is money to you? What is money? Obviously, Lucas touched on the key fundament, the key characteristics of money. But to you, what is money?
Yeah, well, I mean, Luca kind of touched on, you know, the theoretical base of what money needs to be, you know, means of payment, unit of account, store of value. And, you know, if we look at any sort of historical base of what that's been, like Luca said, it's been shells, it's been metal, it's been gold, it's been all sorts of different commodities that have been trialed and tested. And, you know, as of date, we've got fiat, which is paper money. But, you know, when I look at money, I kind of look at it more as a creature of law. You know, it's kind of what governments are willing to accept as tax. It's what people use to obtain power in the world. So I've got a very sort of extreme take on what fiat currently is, and, you know, the issues with it. And I feel like money comes with a lot of responsibility, and I feel just the current financial system that runs on the fiat, you know, mechanism is just failing.
But we'll touch on that in a moment, because obviously I just want to highlight what you guys have both said is brilliant, just in terms of what money is and where it's come from. Obviously, you know, going from prehistoric times to gold, and we had the gold standard. I would motivate people who are not really clear on the history of money. I'd point them to a really valuable book that I'm currently making my way through. It is a long read. It's an intense read, but called The Bitcoin Standard by Safuddin Amous. I would highly recommend that book. It leads you through. He doesn't even talk about Bitcoin until chapter 8. He basically leads you through the history of money, the gold standard, what happened there, what happened with the world wars. It's mind blowing. And if you understand what's going on with Bitcoin, which we'll elaborate on shortly, you'll see the similarities straight away. And to me, I guess, and you know, to echo what you guys said, money is essentially then a trust system. It's something that I give to Luca or you, Jonty, and you assign some value to that because other people assign value to it. And that's, you know, that, I guess that's the other thing that you realize, that money is the biggest network as well. Money is the biggest platform in the entire world. It's the only sort of device that humans are capable of using to translate value over time and space. That's generally accepted. And I guess, gold was the gold standard. Obviously, I mean, it's in the word, but gold, it was the gold standard of money because, and I guess if you look at the characteristics of gold, and then we'll draw the parallel to Bitcoin, I guess, that, and Luca obviously mentioned the store of value. The store of value comes about because there's a limited supply. And if you've been exposed to basic economics, you will understand demand and supply. As a supply of something is restricted, that asset or whatever increases in value. And gold, by its nature, is a supply constricted asset. And I guess that transition from the gold standard to the fiat experiment, I guess, when they decoupled gold from the paper receipts that were redeemable on that? Like, I mean, also, you know, disclaimer obviously is that we're not going to be going deep into that stuff. We do want to talk about Bitcoin and Ethereum, but I think it is a necessary groundwork. With that background, guys, what do you think is the best sort of way to describe the problems with the current fiat sort of money environment? And Jonty, you already touched this, so maybe you can start. What are the problems with the global sort of money supply and how things are done at the moment?
Well, I think the roots of the problem is central control. You know, there's one governing entity that can decide to print money at the click of a button. And ultimately, this just leads to further, you know, prolonged financial pressure. It leads to sort of inflation and all these, you know, reduction in purchasing power. And yeah, I think the root of the issue, to keep it short, is central control over something that should be community governed.
And Luca, what's the problem with inflation for someone, for the average person or for people listening who haven't really thought much about this? I guess in economics, we all get taught about inflation without really understanding what it is. And Jonty made an important point about purchasing power and how, you know, the way things are done right now affects purchasing power and obviously inflation is the sort of the agent that destroys purchasing power. So maybe touch on that and why that's so important in the context of Bitcoin and sound money, I guess.
Yeah, maybe just to underpin kind of one of some of the points you were making. I mean, money is social consensus. And what we're realizing now is we're in a unique situation. We've had economic expansion for however many years. And consensus is not as easy anymore. As a young person, you look at the environment and one of the key questions you ask yourself is, where should I put my money? You know, it's property prices, all-time high, stocks, all-time high, you know, and we have the COVID crisis and governments, I guess, particularly in the US, you know, responded with money printing. And, you know, if the supply of money increases, there's more of it, prices increase, but wage growth necessarily doesn't correspond directly. You know, you might be seeing, and I mean, this is quite a pertinent example right now following this COVID crisis. You know, you've got raw material prices going up. So, you know, people who are building homes will see it, but, you know, it takes time for these things to reflect in wages, for example, or income. It doesn't translate quite as quickly. So if you end up in a situation where, you know, the supply is just continually increasing, prices increase drastically, you know, the average citizen who isn't in assets which are benefiting from this boom in money, so where, you know, if you don't own property, if you don't own stocks, it just increases the wealth divide effectively. So I guess why this is such a wild topic at the moment is because the social consensus issue is really open at the moment. There are cracks kind of emerging on the edges.
Yeah, and I guess the cracks emerging are that the monetary system that's currently in place, and this is being driven by the crypto and Bitcoin community, I guess, is that the monetary system that's currently in place isn't actually serving us. Because when you actually look at history, and then this is something I picked up from that the Bitcoin Standard book, is that gold as the prime money in the world led to the most prosperous period, economic period, and the most prosperous peacetime period that the world has ever seen between, I think it was the late 1800s until World War I, basically. And what you realize is that when you haven't thought much about this topic is that you realize that money should have value over time. It should keep that value, right? And Safuddin talks about saleability over time and space. And in that is retaining value. And then that's where the whole store value argument comes with. But what's been happening now is with drastic increases in the supply of money, if you just have, you know, if the total money supply, for example, to make it simple for people is $100 or whatever, I have $10. That's 10% of the money supply. I'm not going to try to do more public math than that. But basically, if I increase the money supply, to from 100 to 200, okay, that's easy to do. My share of the money supply has now halved. And I think that's the whole thing to get across, is that with this expansive money printing, that there's an erosion of wealth through inflationary pressure on the money supply. And I guess that brings us to how Bitcoin, which has been named digital gold, which has been dubbed digital gold in some sense, and there's an ongoing debate and I guess skirmishes within the crypto and Bitcoin community whether Bitcoin should become the global reserve currency, or is it just, does it best serve as digital gold? We'll get into that. But how does Bitcoin from a high level then, Jonty, solve the problem with the current monetary system, or at least attempt to? How does Bitcoin solve that?
So I don't think it's going to solve it. I don't think Bitcoin is the future of money. I think it's a big step in the right direction. We can get more in depth on it later, but I mean, ultimately, there's one clear example which I can talk about that, you know, highlights why Bitcoin can't be a unit of exchange when it comes to global adoption of a new currency. And that's rooted back to the first ever Bitcoin purchase, you know, back in 2010, the real world first ever commercial transaction with an actual company. And that's the Papa John's pizza. I don't know if you guys are familiar with this, where, you know, a Florida guy named Laszlo paid 10,000 Bitcoin for two pizzas. And, you know, at the time that was valued at $30 or $40 or whatever it was. You know, today at current prices, that Bitcoin's worth, you know, almost $650 million. So when it comes to a unit of exchange, we need, like, you know, we need something that retains value. You don't want to be buying coffee with $3 of Bitcoin today, and then, you know, that coffee is now worth $300 because suddenly the asset that you're buying with has just rocketed. So I think Bitcoin is definitely a step in the right direction when it comes to creating a more community governed medium of exchange, like an ecosystem where people have a say as to what happens with the thing that pretty much dictates what they can do with their life, you know. But I do think Bitcoin is the optimum store of value, because like gold, it retains its value. And yes, people will come with the volatility arguments, but with any young emerging asset class, there are volatility swings. And if we look at, you know, the volatility index since Bitcoin's inception to now, it's continuously decreasing. You know, the volatility swings are becoming a lot less. And I think Bitcoin will be the new digital store of value. I think it will receive, you know, reserve status in terms of like above and beyond gold, you know, because it is hard coded to have a finite supply, you know, where gold is relatively scarce, but there's always new pockets being discovered. You know, there's always new ores. So it's not necessarily a finite supply, you know. So I think, again, Bitcoin is a step in the right direction, going to a more decentralized payment world and, you know, money world. But I don't think Bitcoin is the final answer as to what the money of the world should be.
Sure, that's valid. That's definitely a valid argument in the context that if you look at gold, obviously in the prehistoric times when technology advancements hadn't come a long way, yes, gold did have a limited supply and it was assigned value that way. But I mean, now with technology advancements, if we wanted, you could potentially go into space and find endless supplies of gold in asteroids and that sort of stuff. So in that context, it doesn't. But where I guess Bitcoin bridges the gap, it's not necessarily programmable money, but it's introduced this whole thing of having the most transparent monetary system in the world. And I guess, Luca, if you could touch on then in that, from that context, what is actually Bitcoin for someone who's never really paid much more attention to it than just looking at the price and has sort of maybe heard what Jonty has just said once. What actually is it?
Do you mind if I just touch on the previous point first and then jump over to that question?
Yeah, sure.
I think it's worthwhile going back to the functions of money, like a store of value, unit of account, and medium of exchange. Like, I think it's quite clear that, you know, if you look at Bitcoin transaction fees, for example, it doesn't serve as an efficient medium of exchange. Whereas, you know, if you look at other assets like gold, supply of gold is demand driven. So, you know, the supply of Bitcoin is fixed. It's algorithmic. So in that sense, if you think gold is a good store of value on the basis that it's scarce, if you apply that same logic to Bitcoin, you know, where the supply is not influenced by demand, you can see why in a digital economy where everything is migrating away from the physical into tokenized representations, which are, you know, easily transferable in Web2, Web3, why that's preferable and why it has a good place as a store of value, but may not be a good money in the sense of a medium of exchange.
Sure. So there's a potentially a world where Bitcoin's the store of the digital gold, where people put their assets or convert their money into store value, and because obviously, like we'll touch on that, there's a hard cap of 21 million Bitcoin that will ever exist in the entirety of the human race, right? In the entirety of the human existence, and because of that, and like you were just touching on, when people demand gold, the producers of gold are then incentivized to go and mine more, and
like you said, we could go out to space.
But that's it. Yeah, exactly.
Exactly.
So then
the demand is big enough. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So then, Luca, then jumping back to my original question I posed to you, what actually is Bitcoin then? What is how does it work from not too much of a technical perspective, but from a high level perspective, what actually is it?
To quote Michael Saylor, it's real estate in the digital Manhattan. I guess because of this fixed supply question, you know, you really could look at it like that. You know, I guess real estate in Manhattan is limited. You can't, you know, create more space, so to speak. You know, you can't create more Bitcoin. You're basically buying into a liquid asset with a finite supply.
Yeah.
You can look at it like money. I think that's the key thing. You could, as kind of like moving into the crypto space for the first time, just look at it as money. It's just not good money in the sense of a medium of exchange, but it is good, sound money in the sense of store of value. So sure. I don't think one needs to overcomplicate it. Again, social consensus. I think we're not going to end up at a situation where the whole world comes together and has social consensus on a really complicated definition of something which is widely used. I think the more widely something is used, the simpler the definitions become. And I think at the end, things will condense down to it just being a quasi money in some sense.
That's a great point. And Jonty, I guess while Luca has sort of talked about, a social definition for Bitcoin, or what would the wider population refer to it, people have probably heard of the concept of a blockchain, right? And Bitcoin is built on a blockchain. How does a blockchain work in a very simple sense? How do you think about it, and why does that matter in the context of Bitcoin? Why is a blockchain so important to how Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies operate?
Well, you know, I think we can view this as what a current sort of decentralized basis. Let's look at the internet, you know, Web2. Basically, the internet that we interact with today is a network run by various governing entities. You know, you've got Google, you've got Microsoft, you've got all these, you know, top companies that run, like Amazon, that run various web hosting servers, and that pretty much function the internet. But the internet inherently is a decentralized network, as in it's run off millions of nodes globally. You know, every cell phone is technically a node for the internet. Every laptop, every smart TV, you know, anything that connects to the internet becomes a node. And, you know, the problem with Web2 and the current internet is that in exchange for having access to that, we offer our personal data, which a lot of people don't realize is, you know, whatever we put out on the internet can technically be used by anyone and monetized against us. Now, if we look at what a blockchain is there's various different types of blockchains, you know, that run on various consensus mechanisms like proof of work and proof of stake, which we can touch on a bit later. But ultimately what Bitcoin is, it's we can look at it as a distributed ledger, which was initially created purely for, you know, electronic peer-to-peer payments. And ultimately what happens is you would broadcast your payments out to a set of nodes, you know, as you would when you're connecting to the internet, and miners will come and mine and approve and verify those transactions by mining the blocks. So basically you can look at a blockchain as a completely decentralized network of nodes that run validation based on code rather than, you know, taking information and using it to the wall, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. And I guess the, just to, I guess, explain or echo a bunch of the different points you made, to think about decentralization, I guess you have to think about a bunch of parties that are interacting with each other and that create trust through this algorithm that is coded, hard coded into the Bitcoin algorithm, right? And all of these people, strangers essentially, who are operating on the Bitcoin network to create consensus through decentralization and through the protocol, they are creating trust. And Luca, how does mining actually work, I guess, then? Because Jonty mentioned a couple of points about mining and what is mining actually used for? You mentioned proof of work as well, and I guess it ties in.
Yeah, well, there needs to be some way to add data to the blockchain. In Bitcoin, that would be, you know, some pool of transactions which are approved by the network. That process of stacking states, like you transition from state yesterday where you had 5 Bitcoin and I had 0 Bitcoin to state today where you've transferred 2.5 Bitcoin. So I think blockchains work in states, and there needs to be some mechanism for transitioning, basically building on top of the previous block. And that is how mining works. And it's quite a complicated like interaction with validators. But effectively, the actual production of that next block, that next state, is the process of mining. So one could almost look at it as an updating of the ledger to reflect activity which has happened. And I think maybe just one really interesting thing to touch on here, you've got to give credit to Balaji for this, limitations of kind of proof of work. So before China banned Bitcoin mining, well, pseudo banned Bitcoin mining from coal at least, a lot of the mining activity was concentrated in China. So this discussion Balaji was having on a podcast was really around the limitations of proof of work and what could a network level attack look like on Bitcoin. And I thought it was fascinating to also just think about the limitations for a second of something like proof of work, right? Where effectively, if China put up a big firewall, you would, because how Bitcoin works and with this mining is you can kind of see multiple chains existing concurrently, but the heaviest proof of work chain, the tallest with the most blocks, is what validators accept as the current state. If China put up this firewall, you would basically have a chain in China which continues to be produced and built on, and you would have a rest of world chain. And then if China dropped the firewall later on, all validators in the world would look at China's heaviest proof of work chain, and all other transactions would happen in the rest of the world would not be final anymore. And I think there is some criticism, at least kind of in the banking and finance space, that, you know, Bitcoin cannot guarantee finality. And it's for one of those reasons that these network level attacks are possible.
Sure. And I guess that hints at a move to potentially more efficient proof of stake mechanism, which we will touch on when we get onto Ethereum. But I just want to sort of try and simplify and touch on more of these points and maybe bring you guys in. You please jump in also. But basically, at a simple level, I guess, you both mentioned a ledger, right? And I guess that's what essentially a blockchain is. It's a ledger that records from the first Bitcoin transaction back in 2009 when Satoshi Nakamoto, the pseudonymous creator of Bitcoin, sent a transaction to Hal Finney, or he sent a Bitcoin to Hal Finney through the first actual Bitcoin transaction, all the way from that first one all the way to currently today as we speak. You know, every 10 minutes a block is created on the Bitcoin blockchain, and that public ledger basically is stored on each individual node in this network, right? The point of a blockchain is that every single node, also Jonty and Luca, please jump in and correct me if I'm botching any of this, that the ledger and all the information stored on that blockchain should be downloaded and stored by each node in that network.
A very, very quick way to look at it is it's all open sourced. No matter what point in time, you can go back to anything and see what data was relevant to that node. You know, when was this mined? Why was it mined? What transactions were approved? You can source everything. You know, the entire crypto space is open sourced, which is, just an easy way to view it.
Yeah, which is something unlike we've ever seen. And, obviously to put numbers or sort of a example to a ledger, I guess if anyone studied accounting like myself, you would be familiar with debits and credits. If I receive a Bitcoin from Jonty, that debits my account, that credits his account on the ledger, that's recorded, that's there forever. And another big property about the blockchain is it's immutable. Once that transaction goes through and it's approved by all the miners and the proof of work is done to approve that transaction, it's immutable. You can't ever go back and ever undo that transaction. And I guess another important problem, or another important feature that the Bitcoin blockchain has solved and has never actually failed to do is around the double spend problem. And Jonty, if you want to touch briefly on what the double spend problem is and why it's so important for a cryptocurrency such as Bitcoin, and why, if that double spend problem occurred, why it could potentially dismantle all of the value that Bitcoin has created over the past decade.
Yeah, well, I mean, basically the fear with digital currency is that, you know, someone can send out two transactions, broadcast them twice, and ultimately commit a double spend, you know, action. But inherently, the proof of work consensus mechanism immediately stops this, because everything in the Bitcoin blockchain is timestamped. So miners will only approve transactions in order of them being broadcasted. So if you send out, it's impossible to send out two transactions at the exact same point in time, you know. So everything being timestamped, the miners will validate the first transaction. And then when it comes to the second transaction, they will then immediately be able to see that this is a double spend attack and just not approve that block or not mine that block with that malicious transaction. So the proof of work consensus pretty much removes that risk. The only risk that you run is, you know, if you run into a state where you get a 51%, you know, attack. And this kind of touches on what Steiner was talking about, you know, when it comes to where majority of the approved nodes, you know, and verified nodes take place. And, you know, before the China pseudo ban on Bitcoin mining, you know, China was actually holding most of the Bitcoin mining hubs within the borders of their country. So ultimately, they had some form of centralized control over what mining would happen. And look what happened when they, you know, banned Bitcoin mining, to say it loosely. you know, the hash rates plummeted. And with that, we got a lot of sort of volatility in price action. So, but ultimately, in order to hack a network by 51%, you need billions of dollars, because to mine a Bitcoin block, you need extremely powerful computational like hardware that can solve these mathematical problems, you know, and ultimately approve transactions within a block and then subsequently add that block to the blockchain. So in order to really hack 51%, you're gonna, you know, you need billions of dollars worth of hardware to generate enough power to overtake and capture more than 51% of the network, which is just incredibly unlikely to happen. And at an incredible expense, it's not really worthwhile for hackers or criminals. And ultimately, these Bitcoin miners are continuously monitoring the blockchain, you know, because if they approve, especially in a proof of stake consensus, if you approve a malicious node or a malicious block, you will ultimately end up getting slashed, where you get removed or kicked, or your rewards or your locked stake get slashed, and you basically just end up losing. So Satoshi Nakamoto, the pseudonymous creator or creators of Bitcoin, ultimately created the rewards for mining a Bitcoin block as an incentive to keep the network honest. You know, miners don't want to risk the rewards that they're receiving. And for mining a block, they get given Bitcoin and the transaction fees associated with that block. So there's no reason or incentive for a node validator to commit any form of criminal activity like that, because the rewards that they're receiving, they're incentivized to continue, you know, working on an honest basis. So just to put it like very straightforward, the proof of work consensus runs on timestamped transactions. So the idea of a double spend is not necessarily possible, because the first transaction will get approved, but the second wouldn't, because it's an identical transaction.
Yeah. And I guess that, just following on from that, I guess, you know, Luca and I, earlier this year, we were doing this course by the Web3 Foundation and together and chatting about it afterwards. And they sort of drew this picture of, if something like this did potentially happen, and Luca already alluded to it already, where you have sort of a branching out blockchain, a second blockchain that almost branches out from the initial one. And obviously, which has a potential double spend issue between the two. The second one that gets rejected by the miners and the validators in the network, that blockchain then just ceases to exist at its point, and the main chain then carries on. I think correct me if I'm wrong, Luca, I think I've represented that accurately, if I remember correctly, but that's basically how the underlying functionality works.
When this new block is mined, this needs to be broadcast to all the nodes. Nodes need to accept this in order for that to form a part of the kind of canonical chain, the main chain. I think that's a fair summary. Maybe just to add, I mean, if China has, you know, the majority of the mining power, there are two things that it could do. So thankfully that's not the case anymore. But yeah, like we said, you could have that network level attack where we have these two chains and then it rejoins, and then you have the finality issue. The other thing they could quite literally do, if they were to seize all the mining gear, they could just mine empty blocks. So every time a Chinese miner is basically picked, they would just not include any transactions in that block, and it would slow the whole network down. But fundamentally, I think part of the design is you can't corrupt the fundamental design of Bitcoin, which incorporates the fact that you can't spend your Bitcoins twice, basically.
I guess that's the big problem.
You can't attack Bitcoin by spending Bitcoins twice. It just doesn't work.
It's not possible. Yeah.
And why do you think, just a quick interesting question, I guess, why do you think none of the risks that you both just pointed out with the mining and network level attacks, 51%, why has none of this happened? Or why do you think it just hasn't happened in the past decade? Because surely you'd think, you know, if something were like this were to happen, it would have happened 10 years ago. Why do you think it hasn't happened yet?
Well, you know, just to jump in there, I mean, you can look at the popularity of the network. You know, 10 years ago, Bitcoin wasn't really a thing. It was just, I mean, if you look at any Bitcoin conference 10 years ago, there was like 3 people attending. Nowadays, you've got millions of people attending Bitcoin conferences. I mean, there's this famous video of, I've blanked on the name now, but this guy who was a big Bitcoin advocate speaking about the potential, you know, future that Bitcoin could have for the global economy. And there was one person in a big room of 100 seats listening to this conference back in like 2010 or whenever it was. So it's kind of like there was no incentive for someone to try and commit a 51% hack for a Bitcoin that was valued at sub $1. You know, it wasn't worthwhile. Nowadays, there's so many millions of nodes spread all over the world. It's just the cost of trying to commit something like that is next to, it doesn't make sense. It's just the expense doesn't make sense. So it's just, I guess it comes with the effort that a hacker or someone like that would have to put in. And don't get me wrong, there have been attempts, but ultimately, like Luca said, you know, once a block, like once the node has been validated, that node gets sent out to all the other validators. You know, you have to, with Bitcoin's, you know, cryptography security mechanism, you've got seconds to kind of approve these various nodes and transactions. So it's very, very difficult.
And as we, so just to summarize, I guess, on a high level on what the points that we've said, we've talked about the supply, the fixed cap supply, which inherently gives the network value. It gives it a value as a store value because you know that there will only be 21 million Bitcoins ever in existence. And, you know, there's also come out recently, I heard that, you know, obviously Satoshi, guys, correct me if I'm wrong, but he/they/she had nearly 3 million. They held about 3 to 4 million themselves. So, and no one knows where those Bitcoins are. Are they liquid? Are, you know, have they been lost because just it happened such a long time ago? So that potentially even lowers the supply, right? Which gives it more value.
Yeah. Well, just to jump in there, I mean, there's an estimated stat that says, you know, out of the 21 million, over 5 million Bitcoin is lost to forgotten passwords, lost seed phrases, and thrown away hardware.
Exactly. I mean, there's that famous story from the UK. I don't know if anyone's heard it, that there was this guy who was throwing out old hard drives and like back in like 2011 or something. And like, whoever throws out old hard drives, right? So he threw out and he realized that, I don't know, he had something like 10 Bitcoins sitting on the hard drive that he threw out. Basically in 2018 or 2017 in the run-up, in that first big bull run when Bitcoin ran up to $19,000, that became worth about 250 million pounds. So he then went to the rubbish dump or the landfill where he knew his hard drive was, and he went to them and he said, can I try and dig out my hard drive because I've got about 250 million pounds sitting on there. So I mean, that's just a small example, I think, of many others where people have just lost passwords to their wallets or stuff like that, which basically the point I'm trying to make is that the supply is, yes, hard capped at 21 million, that 21 million Bitcoin will ever be mined or come into existence. But that figure will, at the end of the day, be lower because you'll just have this huge portion of illiquid supply. And then we talked about basically the whole mining mechanism, how the blockchain works, which essentially, you know, at least in my opinion, they've created something like one of the most strongest and secure monetary networks in the entire world, and all being transparent. We know Bitcoin's monetary policy, you know, back to front. We can see every transaction that's ever happened on the network. And which to someone listening, I don't want to say that this is the moment, but I guess this is sort of like, this is when it sort of dawned on me that flip, this thing is really insanely valuable. And just how it's come from basically nothing, and just the significance that this thing was sort of willed into existence first by 30,000 odd lines of code that Satoshi Nakamoto developed, and second of all, just by the Bitcoin community that have literally just put this thing into the world and shoved it down people's throats, for lack of a better word, and just saying this thing is really valuable. And going to public companies, Michael Saylor, as we've mentioned before, the prime example and the sort of the leader in this, saying to public companies, put it on your balance sheet. We've got Jack Dorsey at Twitter through Cash App creating, you know, the probably the biggest on-ramp into Bitcoin. And he's now talking about creating, you know, a segment of his of Square that focuses on Bitcoin mining, creating hardware and software to do mining, which is absolutely huge. And what are your, that's why I want to ask, what are your guys' thoughts on this? I mean, will every public company have to put Bitcoin on their balance sheet as a store of value as their cash and cash equivalents erodes? You know, what is the cultural significance of this, Luca?
Well, I think companies are facing similar issues to everyday individuals, in the sense that companies have cash reserves, and individuals generally, I mean, whether it's bank deposits or actual cash, use these in their everyday lives. And I mean, in the current inflationary environment, it's just difficult to justify cash reserves. And kind of this goes back to the session that Michael Saylor had on corporate strategy. General treasury strategies are not beating the cost of capital anymore. So there's a need for an asset which can beat the cost of capital, and Bitcoin does that. So on the company level, there's a strong case to be made. Then again, you know, the United States dollar is a reserve asset. So maybe the pull in the US is not quite as strong as in the rest of the world, where fiscal monetary policy is not quite as strict, so to speak. So the dollar is a reserve asset, but how many emerging market currencies are sound money in the sense that value is preserved through time? So as a cultural phenomenon, I think with the digitization and the kind of interconnectedness of the world and the proliferation of kind of financial education as well, I think globally, you know, people are waking up to it. And I think the case study there is El Salvador, which is basically lent straight into digital dollarization in the form of Bitcoin. As an alternative to continual debasement, effectively.
And I guess just talking about El Salvador, for those who didn't know, back in, when was it, August or something, they legally, you know, the law came in in the country El Salvador, which is a tiny island basically off of America around Mexico, or I could be completely wrong, but I think just somewhere off the coast there, a tiny island, few thousand people who live on it, but they basically instituted that Bitcoin should become legal tender, which basically means I can take 5 Bitcoin and pay for something. Obviously that's an exorbitant amount of money right now, you know, 5 times $60,000, but basically
you can go buy a McDonald's burger.
Exactly. And that's, I think that's the significance of it, that the world, I mean, in my opinion, it sort of just happened. And then people were like, oh, okay, sort of, you know, there wasn't like a huge, I guess, as much of an uproar in the non-Bitcoin community, I guess. It didn't have as much of an impact, which was weird to me as well, because I guess people are underestimating the significance of it. But now, absolutely, essentially you can take your Bitcoin in El Salvador and exchange it for goods without being, you know, essentially selling a security or commodity, which incurs capital gains tax and all of that sort of stuff. And John T, what are your thoughts? Is every public company in the world, does Google, Amazon, Apple, is every government going to have to put Bitcoin on their balance sheet?
Well, to put it very simply, I think if they want to stay relevant in the future, they're going to need Bitcoin on their balance sheet. Because like Steiner said, you know, they've got to beat the cost of capital. you know, and currently, you know, holding liquid fiat or something like that on their balance sheet just doesn't, you know, with the money printing and all of that going on, that's just continuously decreasing in value. So they need to be holding appreciating assets, and Bitcoin is probably the best store of value in the world at the moment.
Yeah, I think a chart of the 4-year return on investment on Bitcoin, if you plot the rolling 4-year return, I think there are a few days in the history of Bitcoin where that's below a 10x.
Literally, yeah.
It's unreal.
It's crazy.
You're looking at least 200% a year on average.
Exactly. As Michael Saylor always said, I saw a chart the other day, which was also like, you know, Bitcoin's percentage return each year, you know, since basically 2011. And it was, I think the lowest it's been, which has obviously been later in the cycle as it just gets to a crazy huge number in price, is still above 40%. It's like, you know, something stupid, which is unheard of in the normal financial markets. Sorry, John.
I mean, if you, I don't know if anyone listening here does, you know, technical analysis, but I've kind of like specialized in sort of the technical analysis side of trading and all of that and charting and stuff. And if you just take the log charts, the daily log chart of Bitcoin's entire history, it's just in a continuous bull market. You know, people talk about these crazy swings and stuff, but it's honestly the most beautiful uptrend you will ever see on a chart. And that's just ties into the fact about demand and supply, having a fixed supply, you know, that not everyone is going to be able to have access to. I think, you know, there's not even enough Bitcoin on the open market today for every single millionaire to even hold 0.2 of a Bitcoin or something in the world. You know, there's a crazy stat around it. My numbers might be a bit funky there, but basically there is not enough Bitcoin to go around. And
I mean, Jonty, you're right in that a million, like there's definitely not enough full Bitcoins for each millionaire in the world to hold just one Bitcoin, right? Like that, you know what I mean? So now on the open circulating supply, it's even less.
It's even less, exactly.
Yeah,
it's crazy. People are going to have to hold fractions of these things, and they don't realize how valuable, you know, Bitcoin's going to be. And, you know, people say when Bitcoin was $1, people were like, oh, $10 of Bitcoin is never going to be possible. You know, look at us today, $65,000 of Bitcoin. Look at us in 5 years. Who knows? Maybe we'll be at a 7-figure Bitcoin. You know, the appreciating potential and the 4-year ROI of this asset is crazy.
Yeah, it is crazy. And especially when, you know, we've mentioned the hard supply and the hard cap supply, and when a huge spike in demand comes, you know, the charts got nowhere to go. If you know economics, the price just skyrockets. And that's what we're currently seeing play out. I want to touch briefly on the Bitcoin community as a whole with you guys and just the key figures within. And just the general ethos around before we, and I think it's a nice sort of segue into Ethereum. What are your guys' sort of thoughts on the Bitcoin community? Like, what do you, if you were to say in a sentence, like sum them up, I mean, I know we all laughing at that, but yeah, I mean, I guess, what would you think, Jonty?
Let's put it this way. There's the crypto community. And then there's a very, I'm not going to say a clear divide because everyone supports each other, but there's a thing that we call a Bitcoin maxi.
Maximalist.
And then there's, maximalist. Yeah. So, but Bitcoin maxi for short. And basically, you know, there are diehard Bitcoin fans, which think Bitcoin is the future. But then, you know, there are people that research and look into alternative cryptocurrencies, which we call altcoins, like Ethereum, which we will get into now. And personally, I'm an Ethereum maximalist. but ultimately, the community around cryptocurrency is incredible. It's the most open source, community supportive group of people. You can Zoom call the CEO of a company in the crypto space if you want to, because everyone is young, everyone is building, everyone's working towards a brighter future. And it's the most crazy growth driven space. I mean, I work 18-hour days, and you know, half of that day is on calls with people in the community. And it's so fulfilling. chatting to people in the space that have this mindset of bettering the future of humanity. So it's a really amazing community to be a part of.
Luca, what's your outlook on the Bitcoin community?
Yeah, I think we heard the bull case from John T. I think you've got two sides. You know, I think as we move away from traditional kind of currencies, I mean, you know, whether you think Bitcoin is good money or not, it is a currency in the sense. I would say maybe everything that's not meant to be a currency, it's almost like a decentralized project finance, which is accessible. and I think in that space, it's like the Wild West. And with it comes everything good about that and everything bad. So,
but like with any young emerging asset class.
Exactly. Like the lack of regulation means that innovation is free to multiply. But the kind of very brave, maybe not cautious enough, do get caught. And I think, you have to tread carefully. It's just as easily, you know, I mean, you have these hype cycles, which drive these worthless altcoins to new highs, basically, on the topic of project financing. You know, they just have a good marketing campaign and they're pumping these tokens into the market. You know, if you get caught in those hype cycles, you'll be poor at the end of it. So yeah. There's a lot of opportunity. The community is amazing, supportive, but you do need to be careful.
I think Steiner said it perfectly there. The one word description, or the one liner, is it's the Wild West. That's the description.
Yeah.
Crypto community.
And until further regulation comes in, which I'm sure, you know, it's probably on the horizon. We probably don't have time to jump into that now. But I mean, just as a high level summary, I guess it's, you know, Michael Saylor refers to the Bitcoin community as a bunch of cyber hornets that basically attack off everything else that isn't sound money. And I guess that, you know, it's true. I just love it. I must say the community about memes and, you know, for example, when Peter Schiff, someone not necessarily in Bitcoin that you need to follow, but he's a gold aficionado, when people are replying to his Twitter, when people are replying to his tweets about gold with the acronym HFSP, have fun staying poor, and like just memes of, you know, the Bitcoin emblem on the rocket going to the moon, and yeah. You know, it's just
on Peter Schiff. Luke, I need to jump in here. Someone built an algorithm to counter trade Peter Schiff's tweets. So every time the guy was announcing the death of Bitcoin, this bot placed a buy order, and it was crazy successful.
You know, there was
actually successfully called the bottom of pretty much all these volatility swings that we've been through. Every time Peter Schiff tweets, people buy.
But you know, there was that famous one I think it was when COVID really hit the stock market for the first time in March 2020. I think Bitcoin was at $3,000 and Peter Schiff was like, cool, it's going to zero. And then we all know what happened after that, you know. That was the buy order, exactly. I think the same thing happened with Jim Cramer as well at CNBC, where people were creating anti-Jim Cramer portfolios for crypto. But anyway, I think I digress in that, just saying that essentially, I can't put it better than that retail, for the first time in human history, has front ran the institutions. And we've never seen something like this ever happen. You know, the majority of institutional investment has only come into Bitcoin in the past year. There's been, and as Bitcoin people call themselves, you know, they call themselves plebs. The plebs have been around since 2011. And the plebs have been buying in, stacking. Another sort of crypto slang, stacking stats. You know, which is, it's just the craziest thing to wrap your head around. And like you say, I can't say enough, the support of the community is unbelievable. And just the openness, the intellectual curiosity, the openness to new people. Look, you do get a bunch of, you do get some people who do take it out, like, you know, and, you know, John T alluded to the Bitcoin maxis, who do take it one step far and actually almost ostracize themselves from the rest of the world to such an extent because they have such big beliefs, although most people are fighting for the same team, right? I mean, if you are pro crypto, it generally means that you are pro freedom, pro autonomy, pro transparency. All right, people, that's a wrap for part one. I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did filming it. The best thing about this episode is that there is a part two coming next week where we take a deep dive into Ethereum, the second largest cryptocurrency. Lots more to come in that. Lots more meat, lots more exciting stuff. And we pick up exactly where we left off in this episode. So please stay tuned for that one. If you're new to crypto, let this be a springboard for you to dive into more things around Bitcoin and the world of crypto and anything else that intrigues you that we brought up. I've linked some useful resources down below in the show notes. There is a lot, so happy reading, happy researching. And if you're an old timer in crypto already, thanks for tuning in. Keep hodling, keep grinding. And so till next time, I'll see you next week. Bye bye.